This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station,
Joy 94.9.
Are you interested in the unknown?
Video games.
Old movies.
Horror.
Old TV.
Zombies.
Fantasies.
Comics.
The paranormal.
And science fiction.
Old TV. Games and more. Then tune in Tuesday nights at 10.
On Sci-Fi and Squid.
On Joy 94.9.
If you're talking about how Hollywood does it, I suppose, which is what most people are referring to when they say strong female protagonists, I think they are unused to having females as leads, and so they have certain ideas about how they should dress or how they should behave that should be, you know, similar to men or maybe too different from men, and they haven't really found that happy balance of just getting a person to be a main character and, you know, and letting the gender part come second.
This Joycast is a
free service brought to you by Joy 94.9, joy.org.au.
This is Sonia of Sci-Fi and Squeam here on Joy 94.9, and I've got the privilege of talking to Queenie Chan about her work, of course about her artwork and comics and the things that she's working on at the moment, but also because we're going to be talking to her again soon for something in Midsummer coming up in January the 28th. It's called Cartooning with Pride, so that's going to be part of our Midsummer program. I want to welcome you to the show there, Queenie Chan. Thank you for speaking to us.
Okay, no worries.
You're right with that? Okay. Cartooning with Pride is Jimmy Twin's concept, and it was basically he's trying to see what's out there, what sort of topics as far as any comics of queer angle or any comics made by queer people for the LGBTIQ. So that people know that, look, there is something they can go to. I know that there's a lot of sort of biographical and independent comic makers that identify as queer or do queer topics. But you yourself, Queenie Chan, you have been around for quite some time as an artist and doing lots of different work. You know, what can you tell us about your history there as an artist?
Okay, right, I'll talk about my work first.
Yes, cool.
I'm a writer and illustrator, and I draw comics mostly in the manga style. For people who don't know what manga is, it's basically comics from Japan. Manga is what the Japanese call their comics, and unlike in the West, I think, manga is very popular. And has been for decades. And so they have a much wider spread of genres and things like that compared to Western comics. I first started in 2004 doing a story called The Dreaming for an American company called Tokyo Pop. It's a very Australian story. It has a lot of references to Picnic at Hanging Rock. And because of that, it's very feminine. And I think I chose that story to show to an American audience because I wanted to show some aspect of Australian culture, which I felt was different to the Crocodile Dundee sort of very masculine ochre culture that Americans know. So anyway, after The Dreaming, I worked with Dean Koontz and Carly Chan, both are prose authors, and they decided to release graphic novel prequels to their work. After that, which is where I'm now, I actually am doing something a little bit different. I'm doing something that I call comics prose, which is mixing prose and comics together. And the story I'm doing now is called Fabled Kingdom, which is a fairy tale inspired fantasy story, so that's what I'm working on right now.
Cool. Wow, that sounds amazing. You're a very busy woman, of course. I'm just looking on the website about all the work that you do, and there's a lot going on there. Fabled Kingdoms looks just marvellous. And will this be in print or just digital?
Both.
Fabulous.
I think while we're on the subject, since I'll probably bring this up on Jimmy's festival as well, I think print-on-demand these days is very common and getting more common. I think more people should know about it because I think some people think you really need a traditional publisher to go into actual print, and I say that's not true anymore. Even when it comes to bookstores, if your book's popular enough and you're self-publishing, bookstores will still take your book if you know how to get it printed yourself.
Yeah,
so it's just a matter of getting educated about where to get it printed and how to do the printing process properly so you get a quality book.
Yeah, because that's what people want to see, I guess, of course. You walk into a lot of comic stores and there still are, obviously, from the bigger companies and so on, but for a small publisher, yeah, it's a bit, I guess, of an expense and a gamble that they do feel they're taking.
Yeah, but it can be quite cheap because while if you print a single book, it is the shipping is going to cost you. But if you print like 100 books or 10 books or 50 books, there is a way to sell it by hand or through your website.
Oh, okay.
So if you're not treating it like a serious business where you have to earn back a certain amount
of
money.
Yes, right, a living.
You treat it like a form of self-expression.
Yes.
Now, I think it's completely doable.
Yes, yes.
Sustainable.
It seems to be the case for many, I know, Melbourne comic artists. It's more of a creative, passion that they have. They have their other job,
Oh, yeah. It's true for most comic book artists, I think. Mm. Even in the US, because right now publishing is going through a bit of a tailspin thanks to changes in technology. Mm. And we've had ebooks a few years ago and there was massive adoption, but that's kind of plateaued and people haven't changed their business models to cope with this new landscape. Then you have the internet where everyone expects things to be free, and then there's YouTube and all these other distractions that keep people from reading as much as they used to. So it would be nice if publishers would, make their big changes to adapt to this new ecosystem. But if you're talking about the big publishers, the ones that do pay enough to make for someone to make a living, even them having trouble coping with it, and they're big, they're owned by big media companies, and the changes that require of them are quite radical. So it's going to take a while. So while we're in this stage of transition, now a lot of people are finding that they need a second job, but that's always been the case for people who work in the arts.
Oh yeah, of course. you're a waitress and you do blah blah. That seems to be the way, isn't it? Exactly. And grants, and when funding doesn't work out, you've got to have something to fall back on.
Yeah, at least Australia. One thing, Australia's a small market and always has been. And so there's very few people who do make a living from their art. And this does sometimes even include best-selling authors, because I know some. Yeah, but they do what they enjoy. And secondly, the good news is that the government recognizes and tries to encourage Australian artists. So they do give out grants, something that doesn't always happen in other countries.
True, that is true.
I think Australians at least have that to consider, that they are quite lucky in that they have the Public Lending Rights and the Educational Lending Rights Act. That's given a bit of money every year if you get into libraries, and the government support.
And if you're lucky, there's scholarships and things like that that can work out sometimes, at least for a little bit of time for a creator. Now, you yourself as a creator, looking at just your experience as a woman in the industry itself, what's that been like?
Oh, it's been quite interesting. I will have to do a bit of explaining about my situation. A comics field is very broad, and there's a huge range of art styles and attitudes and lifestyles and people of various ages, people from various generations who have a different approach to comics as an art form. Like for me, I grew up in Hong Kong, and I left when I was 6 years old, but I grew up reading manga, Japanese-style comics, and that was what I understood as comics. It wasn't until I was much older that I became aware of Western comics, superhero comics, indie comics, that kind of scene. And by then, I was already working as a manga-style comic book artist for Tokyo Pop. And the thing is, at that time, manga became exposed to a Western audience through the internet. Yeah. And Tokyo Pop was a company that was able to seize that moment and turn it into for a while, that was a big business. But unfortunately, because of the way they did it and the way they marketed it when trying to grow the business, they put out this idea that manga is for girls. Uh-huh. And they start off doing that because it was a business decision. Mm-hmm. They thought that in America, that superhero comics appealed to men and primarily to men. And so they thought, well, we're going to do something different with this manga thing. We're going to appeal to girls and get girls into bookstores. And that was their plan. And it worked wonders. It worked really, really well. And unfortunately, it did create a kind of perception within the existing Western comics community that manga is for girls. And so it does create a problem that when I draw, and I draw in a manga style, even though I'm Australian and totally not Japanese, some people, when they look at my work and they see the style in which it's drawn in, they immediately put in a box and say, oh, this is for girls. It's not really for me. Or some people won't recommend it to their sons because they say, oh, manga's for girls. And that attitude is filtered down to even a younger generation, teenagers, who you would think would be the primary audience for.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of created a schism in the industry that not a lot of people like to talk about. Because there is when people talk about manga and it's like, oh, I don't really read manga, they could not read manga for a variety of reasons. One of them could be the artwork, others could be just the cultural differences and they don't enjoy it. And yet the third one is that if you're a Western comic artist and you draw in a manga style, that comes with an entirely different type of baggage. Yeah, that's very hard to get rid of.
Yeah, no, I've actually, that has been interesting. And there's also, I guess, for our sort of audience too, with the LGBTIQ, the interest in manga has been the sexuality aspect and the gender diversity and that type of thing.
Yes.
So that comes up quite frequently for people I talk with.
That's very interesting. There's an entire subgenre, huge subgenre, in Japan, and this is a cultural thing, because even though it has a lot of Western audiences, it did originate from Japan for very Japanese reasons. And it's called Boys Love, BL. But the whole point of it is women drawing erotic comics for women, straight women drawing erotic comics for straight women, who use, I think, bishonen, they call them bishonen, which is beautiful boys, and depicting them in romantic and sexual relationships.
That's right, yes.
For titillation purposes. And people find this very fascinating because this culture isn't really hidden. It's not really something that the girls are ashamed of over there. If you go to Japan and go to the Comiket or any of their doujinshi sort of conventions, it is doujinshis are kind of fan-made magazines, which is huge over there. A lot of people sell it openly and they don't have an issue with it whatsoever.
Yep.
Mainstream Japanese are probably a bit, they're not very comfortable with the sexuality aspects of manga in general, including this. But if you're talking about the subculture and on a wider, the feminine culture of Japan, they're very accepting of it. But I would also say that for BL, while it's got a lot of fans, and you have its Western equivalent like Slash in, 70s sci-fi, for example, Star Trek,
there's
another movement of Slash fiction. I'm not quite sure that it is an expression of queer desire. And this is something that I talk about with people from now and then, because they think, it sounds very gay positive. You have these,
but it's actually written by straight women for straight females.
Yes, and that's
originally,
I don't have an issue with that, because it is subversive in its own way from a Western point of view. But to say that because that you have two men getting it on and everyone's fine with that, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an expression of gay people. And in fact, in Japan, some gay men do say that BL doesn't help their cause at all, because it depicts really idealized versions of gay relationships that has nothing to do with reality and isn't even made for gay people. Mm. And the characters, as many BL artists will tell you, the characters aren't even meant to be gay. That is problematic from my point of view.
No, I've come across that just talking to a bloke at the Wollongong University who studies that type of thing, and he said, he's visited Japan several times, of course, and he says it's just different. So when he comes back here, he has a lot of gay male friends who like to read those comics, but they're not saying they're not aware, but to know that the actual history of it and the origins is totally opposite of perhaps what they're reading it for. So it's quite interesting, that translation how it works.
I think gay men enjoying BL comics is interesting. I think it's completely fine. Just like there's lesbians enjoying gay porn made for men.
That's right,
straight girls, actually. Kidding, I mean, that sort of thing. It's titillation, I'm completely fine with that. But I do find it interesting that they do enjoy it, because when you think about it, it is kind of like romance novels written by women. There's a lot of themes of domination and submission in these stories, and they're meant to be pure fantasy. So if you're a gay person and that's what you want out of your entertainment, your erotic entertainment, then that's great. But some other gay people that I've known has found it offensive.
Yeah, it's just kind of split down the middle, and there's a whole other, I guess all those other subgenres like Sailor Moon and things like that also come up quite frequently. And we see that at conventions quite a lot. When I go to, we see a lot of Sailor Moon cross-play as well, with men dressing as Sailor Moon and queer men identifying in that respect. So, it's interesting.
But I think Sailor Moon and the anime and manga community has always been very accepting of cross-dressing, which I think is very interesting compared to, I say, if you go to a more Western comics kind of convention, that sort of thing won't go down so well. If you go to an anime and manga, it's like, whatever, nobody cares. They think it's funny, they think it's cool, and they have a problem with it. But if you see it at a more superhero-oriented convention, well, actually, I've never seen it at a more Western pop culture oriented.
It happened in Melbourne, Oz Comic Con, which was at the, and PAX. PAX was at the, actually I saw it more at PAX, at the Melbourne Exhibition Centre here.
Was that the Penny Arcade?
Yes, the second time they've had it in Australia at Melbourne. And I must admit, I've never seen so many men Sailor Moons. in groups. And actually, they had a policy about nudity or semi-nudity, the actual people who, you know, run the, of course, who run the event. And fair enough, too, within reason, obviously, because there's going to be, you know, it's also, it crosses everybody at Penny Arcade, of course. And I saw a couple of volunteers looking at what the guys were wearing, and they got through.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting to see that PAX was open enough to that. And I probably saw in one situation, I saw about 12 guys dressed as Sailor Moons. In one group, walking along, and I was like, wow, okay, that's changed.
Yeah, I think with Penny Arcade, because they're a gaming community, gaming has always been very accepting of anime and manga, because a lot of the the older games that were very influential, a lot of them came from Japan.
Yes.
And so that comes tagged with the whole Japanese pop culture thing, that which includes anime and manga. And so that community has always been a lot more accepting of that anime manga aesthetic compared to, I guess, superheroes. They tend to be hyper-masculine, both in art form and as white male power, you know, straight white male power fantasies. And that is very apparent from the themes they explore and the way they draw men, the way they draw women. So if you are the kind of person who wants to disrupt that, you know, that delicate balance, and do something that will blow some mind out of the water, I think they would not react quite as well. I'm not saying that they are closed-minded, because I don't think they're not. I know a lot of superhero artists who are very open-minded.
Yes.
You'll be totally fine with that. But I'm just talking about the general readers as a whole.
Yeah, in the mainstream, I guess, yes.
Yeah.
We've gone off about the track. Sorry about that. But it is fascinating. And you do know a lot about this, and you've experienced it, no doubt, with the people you've interacted with and the work that you produce. As far as queer elements, what you've put into, can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I'm straight, but I have lots of gay friends, and we talk about it from time to time. I think even before I started drawing my own work, I do talk about gay issues with some of my gay friends, and they always mention that for them, they never really made their gayness a point. Me, I grew up in a girls' school where there was a fair amount of lesbianism amongst my classmates, and I was like, yeah, whatever. So my exposure to queer culture and gay people, or even bi-curious people, because a lot of my lesbian classmates turn out to be straight eventually, so it's like, okay, you know, it doesn't define them as a person for me. So because of the way I've grown up and been exposed to it, when I do have gay people in my work, I don't make a point of their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I don't think it defines them as a person. And so for some people, that's what they prefer, and for some gay people, they don't really want that. They do want a character who is upfront about their sexuality, because maybe sexuality defines them more as a person compared to some of the other people I know. So when I do tackle gay themes in my story, I never bring it to the surface. And besides, I also feel that if you're talking about a story that is like a coming out story, or a story where gay sexuality takes the main point of view, I feel it's important for an actual gay person to do that, because they have the experience and the understanding and the, well, I say, more kind of the ability to paint it in a way that is more authentic. I mean, I can try doing that, but I don't think what I do will be as authentic or as powerful anywhere near as that if a gay person did that. So what I think, at least in gay culture and in comics, is that to encourage more gay people into talking about their experiences, if that's what they want to share.
Have you ever worked with, say, a gay writer to do that, collaborated to make something?
No, not really. Like I said, most of my gay friends are open about being gay, but not completely open. As in
not everybody knowing about it, right.
Yeah, nobody's in that format. The closet. You know, which I find interesting, because I am Asian, and I do have a lot of Asian friends, so a lot of my gay friends are from Asian families.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to see how their families reacted when they finally chose to came out. Mm-hmm. And their families have always known, you know, but some of them are like, oh, you know, it's a phase that they'll get through or something like that. But I've seen, like most of them came to an easy truth of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also seen gay friends where their families accepted their partners with open arms, and everyone's very happy at Christmas.
That's the main thing.
I went to a Christmas party hosted by a gay couple who had all their parents with them and all their friends.
Lovely.
Everyone's like so happy.
Yeah.
So that was surprising, but it can happen. So it's people love their children. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day.
Yeah, because sometimes there's some very negative portrayals, particularly I guess of Asian families and the gay aspect. You do hear of problematic stuff, but it's good to know too, part of life. So they accept them, and that's a good thing. Definitely. Yeah.
I think I'm just lucky with the people I know. I'm sure there are families that just react badly to this.
Yeah, I guess it depends if they're very conservative, I guess, and cultural beliefs and stuff.
Well, I think in terms of Chinese culture, at the very least, is that they expect sons to produce sons.
Exactly, yeah.
And I don't actually have any lesbian friends that much. So unfortunately, I can't really say anything about the lesbian experience of being, you know, coming out to your family.
But I guess it goes back to the gender roles that we play, you know, at the end of the day, and where we think men have to provide this status thing, perhaps, and probably goes back to that. Now, speaking again about being a woman, before I let you go, being a woman in the industry, do you think it's important to have strong female protagonists in your comics and in the work you do?
Oh, absolutely. Pretty much, I would say the majority of my protagonists are female. Mm-hmm. And once again, I don't make a point of it. I think it's not unusual for me because in anime and manga, there are a lot of female protagonists. And many of them are not sexualized either. And in Asian pop culture, I grew up watching a lot of wuxia novels and, I mean, wuxia TV series and movies as well. And if you've seen them, they're full of fighting women, you know, and female protagonists. And they beat up the guys as well. Like, it's not, their gender is never an issue in these stories. So when you grow up watching them, it's like, oh, you know, it's nothing unusual for a nice middle-class girl to go out and get a sword and then beat up a whole bunch of people in the street. You know, that's what I grew up looking at. And so when I draw, I write my own stories, I kind of express it that way as well. I mean, the female protagonist thing is not a big deal. I like drawing it because I like writing stories about girls more than guys, I suppose, my point of view.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, of course it's very important to have strong female protagonists, but I also think that if you're talking about how Hollywood does it, I suppose, which is what most people are referring to when they say strong female protagonists, I think they are unused to having females as leads, and so they have certain ideas about how they should dress or how they should behave that should be, you know, similar to men or maybe too different from men, and they haven't really found that happy balance of just getting a person to be a main character and, you know, and letting the gender part come second.
No, true. And sometimes they just swap it. They go, right, okay, well, we'll put a female in there with a male role and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that
there's
can
been places
happen.
Where it's been very successful, like Angelina Jolie, when she played that, I think, Salt in that movie.
Yes,
that
Wanted.
That was originally written for Tom Cruise, and then she's like, oh, I can do it.
Yeah.
And she could.
And, I mean, it was great. I really like Wanted as well. She was in that too, and she did really well in that. And Ripley, of course, for Alien, that was originally written for a male character. That was a male character.
Oh, yeah, that made that franchise special. Mm. It was really Ripley that made that franchise stand out in a lot of people's mind.
Definitely, yeah.
And that set it apart. I mean, it was a very good movie, Alien. Mm. But having a female lead back then was bucked conventions in ways that made people remember.
And it's made it last. In fact, it's made it doesn't date. I know it's set in the future in space, but it doesn't actually date.
Yes.
Because I believe because of that strength of that character and the way it worked out in the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes all the movies.
Yeah.
I know some people hate them, but no, I love all of them for that. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll probably wrap it up because I have taken up a lot of your time. But what a great thing it is for you to work with someone like Dean Koontz as well.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was an honour.
Yeah. Will you be working more with him in the future?
Probably not. He wanted to do Odd Thomas because he, being a forward-thinking person, he wanted to, at that point in time, he wanted to target a younger audience for his work. And so, because Odd Thomas was, he does horror, so it's not really for children, but Odd Thomas, out of all his work, A, was the best-selling, and B, probably appealed to children the most because it had the least, I would say, adult elements to it from a horror perspective. So he thought we could take this character and make it appeal to a younger audience, introduce them to the books. I mean, this is one way we could do it. And so that's why we did those manga-style graphic novels.
Yeah. Well, they're brilliant. It's a great idea. And it's part of that YA young adult fiction, I think. You know, one of the mainstays would be that work and others. Yeah, it would be great to see that.
Yeah, so I think librarians would probably understand the make a direct line from A to B. And so hopefully that would introduce Odd Thomas at the very least to some of the his teen audiences.
Yeah, it just gets them on the way, doesn't it? They follow that thread, they'll find all sorts of great stuff. So as they get older too, which is fabulous. Yeah, and you've been very much part of that. So I want to thank you so much for the work you have done to date. It's just brilliant. When I do look at your work, I go, oh, that's fabulous. And you've got that real style. It's very unique. And it's good to know that we've got Australians doing the stuff that's been out there, and also the support that you give women and queer culture, which is fabulous.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for interviewing me.
Thanks so much, Queenie. That's Queenie Chan speaking to us here on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9. And we'll hear more of her, of course, with A Cartooning with Pride, which is coming up part of our fabulous Midsummer Festival, and it's on January the 28th. So mark that in your calendar. It's at 7 p.m. and it's free. So this is the great thing about a lot of Midsummer stuff. It's free for the whole community. So that's just brilliant. This is Sonia on Sci-Fi and Scream, Joy 94.9.
Queer geeks alone, because not all geeks are the same, and not all queer geeks are the same. Queer geeks alone, because allies are important, and because you can like Batman and Spider-Man. Queer geeks alone, because Professor Oak doesn't know how to politely ask which pronoun you prefer, and then goes on to assume you're cisgendered anyway. Queer geeks alone, because we want to explore stories and worlds as characters other than straight white dudes. Queer geeks alone, because we want to explore stories and worlds as characters that represent ourselves.
Queer geeks of Oz.
Because we want to explore stories and worlds as characters other than ourselves.
Queer geeks of Oz.
Because we want to see what it would look like if we put Tumblr on a stage.
Queer geeks of Oz.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.